bank manager's office, the words would refuse to come to him, and he'd be left standing there looking stupid. The Dunn men weren't big on words. So he relied on his wife. He readily accepted that there were things which she knew that he did not, including how much water it took to drown a child. Despite his mother's fears and Arthur's occasional guilt-ridden, mostly repressed wishes, Jake didn't drown or fall off the roof or get run over by a car, and he grew into a lovely, sunny child. Those were the words Arthur's mother used to describe him. Everyone loved him. She said that, too. It's because he's so cheerful, she said, so interested in everything and everyone. Arthur studied his own reflection in the square of mirror in the bathroom. His big, plain face and mud-colored hair. Sunny wasn't the word that sprang to mind. What would the right word be? Not cloudy? Overcast? Dull? That was it. Dull. He even felt dull. As for being interested in everyone and everything, well, he wasn't. Most people and most things were boring when you got right down to it. But he didn't believe Jake was all that interested either. He just looked as if he was. Even as a small child, he had better control over his face than Arthur did. He could make it express anything he wanted, regardless of what was going on beneath the surface. He could make his face shine with interest and enthusiasm when Arthur knew for certain that inside he was wearing either a sneer or a yawn. He only bothered to do it with adults, of course. They were the ones worth impressing. He would greet any adult who crossed his path as if he or she were his favorite person on this earth. He'd say, "Hi, Mrs. Turner," and his face would light up and glow with warmth as big old, fat old Mrs. Turner waddled up. And then, 5 minutes later, when she'd pressed a nickel into his hand and gone beamingly on her way, he'd be imitating the waddle and trying to persuade you to do knock and run on her door. Arthur, on the other hand, was forever being told he looked glum. He wasn't glum. It was just the way his features sat on his face. And when adults crossed his path, he kept his head down, because he had no idea what to say. "You'd better watch out, Arthur," the teacher said. "Your little brother's going to catch up with you." It was Jake's first year at school. Arthur was in grade 6. He had to set off for the 2-mile walk to school 15 minutes earlier than he used to, because Jake couldn't walk as quickly and mustn't arrive at school all tired out from running to keep up. Arthur didn't see why they had to go together. There were no hazards to pass on the way to school that he was aware of, no raging rivers to cross, no mountains to climb. Bears ambled through the area from time to time, but no more often than they had when he was Jake's age, and no one had worried about him being eaten by a bear. But it turned out there was something to worry about after all. In the past year or so, strangers had been wandering up the long road from the south. Hobos, people called them. They were looking for work, his father said. It seemed that in the world outside, there were no jobs anymore. From time to time, one of the hobos would knock at the kitchen door and ask if he could help out in the fields or chop firewood or anything else that needed doing, anything at all. Arthur's father felt sorry for them and would have been happy to employ one or two, but he couldn't pay them. Money was something farmers, the ones around Struan anyway, had never had much of, and nowadays they had even less. Arthur's mother felt sorry for the men, too, and gave them food sometimes, but she was also afraid of them. Who knew what a desperate man might do? So Arthur was obliged to become his little brother's bodyguard, escorting him to school and back, protecting him from what exactly? What did his mother think a hobo might do to Jake? Eat him? Arthur couldn't imagine, but he knew better than to argue. Before the end of Jake's first week at school, Arthur knew something else, which was that being at school with Jake was not going to be a picnic. All 8 grades were taught together, 8 rows of desks, grade 1ers along the wall nearest the door, grade 8ers nearest the windows, so comparison of siblings was more or less inevitable, and that Jake would outshine him in every way was inevitable, too. Arthur had suspected for some time that it was his father he took after in the brains department. All his father knew about was farming, and that was all Arthur was ever going to know about, too. He was a dunce at school. His mother had told him that book learning was important, so he tried, but none of it made any sense. Miss Karpinski would ask him a question, and he wouldn't have the first idea what she was talking about. "Can you define an adjective for me, Arthur?" she would say, impatience already licking at the edges of her voice, although he hadn't yet had time to fail to know the answer. She was much younger than Arthur's mother, and wore dresses with round white collars and belts pulled so tight at the waist that it was surprising she didn't break in half. "Come on now, we've just done it, haven't you been listening? An adjective is a part of speech that... what does it do?" He had no idea. Jake did, of course. He sat on the far side of the classroom with the youngest kids, smirking at Arthur's stupidity. He had been born knowing what adjectives did. So schoolwork was added to the list of things that Jake could do and Arthur could not. The list got added to at regular intervals. Jake could whistle, for instance, while Arthur's mouth was somehow the wrong shape. Jake could ride a bike. The length of time between Jake's first sitting his small neat behind on a bicycle seat and being able to spin off on it unaided and in control was about 3 minutes, whereas something about bikes eluded Arthur. He knew only one other person who couldn't ride a bike, and that was his father, who had never tried, because he said he couldn't see the point. But Jake's best trick was the way he could make their mother glow. He would wrap his arms around her and hug her with all his might. Arthur wondered why his mother liked it so much, considering how fierce it was, but she loved it, you could tell. So one evening, Arthur tried it. He went up to her while she was peeling the potatoes for supper and put his arms around her and squeezed, carefully because he knew he was much stronger than Jake and didn't want to hurt her. She stopped what she was doing and looked down at him in puzzlement. She said, "What is it, Arthur?" Not unkindly, just perplexed. He was embarrassed. He thought he must somehow have done it wrong, squeezed too hard or not hard enough or not in the right place. Then he thought maybe he was just too old, that only little kids could do that sort of thing. But Jake didn't stop doing it as he got older. The hugs got less intense and less frequent, but he still hugged her from time to time, and it still had the same effect. It was as if he flicked a switch and a light came on inside her. She would glow for half an hour afterward.
"Time Jake started helping out," Arthur's father said when Jake was 7 years old. They just finished supper. Arthur's father was sitting sideways in his chair at the table, mending a harness. He had a leather needle, fearsomely sharp. He'd already stabbed himself with it twice, which was maybe what had given him the head of steam necessary to bring up the subject of Jake, and he was forcing it through the leather with the help of a pair of pliers. Arthur's mother was washing the supper dishes. Arthur was at the far end of the table cleaning the shotgun, a job his father had entrusted to him on his 12th birthday, and of which he was hugely proud. His father had taught him to use the gun as well, and said he'd give him 5 cents for any rabbit or crow he shot. Rabbits being good for the pot, and a real nuisance around the row crops, and crows being just plain evil. Jake had disappeared the minute his plate was empty, like he always did. They could hear him outside. He created so much fuss when Arthur was allowed to shoot the gun and he was not, that his mother had bought him a bow and arrow set, a small one from the Hudson's Bay. He'd painted a big round target on the side of the barn, and every now and then there was a thwack as an arrow landed. Arthur knew that during the day, when their father was out in the fields and their mother was safely occupied elsewhere, Jake had a different sort of target. He would heap a couple of handfuls of dry grass and twigs around the bottom of a fence post and half-fill an empty tin can with gasoline from the tank in the barn. Then he'd set the can on top of the fence post, light his heap of dry grass with a match, and attempt to shoot the can off the post. When he succeeded, there would be a gratifying whoosh, and flames would leap up the sides of the post. He was usually pretty quick to douse it with water, but even so a number of fence posts were getting badly charred, and one of these days their father was going to notice. Arthur worried about this. In the past couple of years, his role as his brother's protector had widened to include protecting him from the consequences of his own actions. Their father was an even-tempered man, and it took a lot to make him wrathful. But Jake could provide a lot, and when their father really got going, it was an awesome sight. Arthur had been thrashed by him only once, for leaving a stump fire unattended, and he'd taken care not to give him cause again. Jake had been whipped several times. He'd made the most of it, walking with a limp for days, but it had been their mother who really suffered. And so Arthur suffered too. Moreover, he suspected that their father did as well. He had no wish to hurt his wife, and would have spared her if he could, and that made him madder at Jake than ever. So Arthur started going out after each of Jake's arson attacks and surreptitiously scraping away the charred wood from the base of the posts. Sometimes he had to sand them down to get rid of the black. Now Arthur could hear the reluctance in his father's voice as he brought up the subject of Jake helping with the chores. He hated a confrontation with his wife more than he hated crows. "Oh, I don't think he's big enough yet, Henry." Arthur's mother turned around from the sink. "You only have to look at him."
"I did look at him," Arthur's father said, reluctance dragging his voice down to a mumble. "He looks big enough to do chores, feed the chickens, take out the swill bucket, things like that."
Jake chose that moment to bound in from the farmyard.
"You think you're pretty strong, Jake?" Arthur's father asked. "Or are you still just a kid?" "Sure I'm strong," Jake said, grinning. "I can beat Arthur."
"Arthur let you beat him," his father said, "so that don't prove nothing. See if you can lift that chair." He nodded at a kitchen chair. Arthur's mother turned around to watch, anxious, her hands dripping suds. Jake grabbed the chair by its back and heaved it off the ground. He swung it back and forth in tight arcs, grinning at the three of them.
"Bet you can't carry it to the door," his father said, and Jake lurched over to the door.
"That doesn't prove anything, Henry," their mother said.
"Sure does. If he can lift the chair, he can lift the swill bucket."
"There's a world of difference between lifting something and carrying it all the way out to the barn."
"Not such a big difference as all that."
Arthur's father put down the harness and wiped his hands on his shirt front, then picked up the harness again and stared at it hard. Maybe he was going to have to stab himself with a needle again before he could carry on. Arthur's mother pursed her lips. She looked at Jake and said, "You go on outside now, Jake. You too, Arthur." Arthur carefully put the gun down on the table and followed Jake outside. They made a show of going around the corner of the house and then slid back and flattened themselves against the wall by the kitchen door.
"He's just a baby still," their mother was saying.
There was a pause, during which Arthur imagined he could hear his father thinking there was a good reason for that. He said,
"Arthur was doing plenty at that age."
"Arthur's suited to farm work. Jake isn't. You can see that."
Arthur glanced sideways at Jake. Jake grinned at him. He had great confidence in his mother's ability to win arguments on his behalf. Their mother said, her voice quiet but full of pride,
"Don't you see that Jake is different? He's so clever. He's going to have choices, Henry. He will have something better than this."
Arthur could hear their father's baffled silence. What could be better than this? Finally, he said,
"Still, won't do him no harm to do his share. Do him good.
He sighed, and Arthur imagined him wiping his hands on his shirt again. "He's going to grow up soft, Mary, if he don't do no work. He should do his share. Look at Arthur. Didn't do him no harm at all doing chores when he was Jake's age. He'd done them well, and I don't remember hearing him complain." Arthur felt a strange sensation of pride swelling in his chest. He had taken the work for granted. It was what people did, the people he knew anyway. His friend Carl Luntz worked alongside his father, and his two elder brothers just the same. Arthur had never questioned it, certainly never expected to hear praise. He felt Jake's eyes and turned his head to look at him. Jake's mouth was puckered tight with disgust. His eyes were dark, and Arthur had trouble reading their expression. It wasn't respect or admiration, though. That was for sure. Arthur's mother was wrong when she said that everybody loved Jake. There were exceptions. "Charlie Taggart threw my schoolbook in the mud," Jake said. He and Arthur were walking home from school. It was September, the worst time of the year as far as Arthur was concerned. Endless months of school ahead, cooped up in one stuffy schoolroom at a too small desk, while outside the maples flamed red and gold and the air was as clear and pure as spring water. Inside was the leaden weight of boredom. Outside was the sharp tang of wood smoke and the urgency of shortening days. You could smell the winter coming. You could see it in the transparency of the light and hear it in the harsh, warning cries of the geese as they passed overhead. Most of all, you could feel it. During the day, the sun was still hot, but as soon as it dipped down behind the trees, the warmth dropped out of the air like a stone. Like the boys on other farms, Arthur headed for the fields as soon as he got home from school in the afternoons in order to get a couple of hours of harvesting in before dark. It had been bone dry right through June and July, and then, just as they were coming up to the corn harvest, there'd been a solid week of rain, and they'd have to wait for the crop to dry out. Now it was dry, and Arthur's father was out in the field sun up to sundown. He came in at night, covered in dust and sweat and tired, almost past eating. Arthur would gladly have played hooky and worked beside him all day, but his mother forbade it, and his father let on that he agreed with her. Jake helped when he was told to, then and at no other time, and he worked so slowly and ineptly and with so much complaint that his father said it was hardly worth the bother, though he bothered anyway as a matter of principle. Jake might as well have been growing up in the town for all the interest he showed in the farm. "Dad says, do you want to come and help with the calving?" Arthur said. His father had sent him to fetch Jake, thinking calving at least would interest him. Surely anyone would be interested in a new life beginning.
"Do what?"
Jake was playing with a pack of cards he'd found somewhere. His hands moved swiftly, fanning the cards out and folding them together again. They made Arthur think of bird's wings.
"Come and help. Jessie's having her calf." "Can't she do it herself?" Jake asked. "She must be able to, or there wouldn't be any cows in the world. They'd all have died out, like the dinosaurs."
It was a good thing it was Arthur that Jake said it to, and not their father. Arthur knew that Jake was just being logical and meant the comment seriously, but their father would consider it a smart remark, and Jake's smart remarks made him mad.
"Don't you want to come and watch, even?"
"Not right now."
Jake slipped all the cards with faces into a certain order so fast you could hardly see his hands move.
"I'm kind of busy. Later, maybe."
It was school he lived for, school and all the goings-on there, triumphs and disasters, friends and enemies, especially enemies.
"Look at it," Jake said as they walked home together.
He pulled a book out of his school bag and brandished it at Arthur. It was covered in mud. Under the mud you could just make out a dark green cover and the title in gold print, English History. Arthur remembered it, dimly. Kings and queens, dozens of them, wars, dozens of those too, and all of them with dates, as if anyone cared. Miss Karpinski said the purpose of studying history was that if you didn't, you were doomed to repeat it. But as far as Arthur could see, the history books proved that you were doomed to repeat it anyway, so what was the point?
Look at the state it's in.
Jake opened the book, more or less in the middle. It looked as if someone had placed it face down in a puddle and leapt up and down on it half a dozen times.
Miss Karpinski is going to kill me.
He sounded really worried. No, she won't, Arthur said. Miss Karpinski loved Jake. He was the last person in the school she would kill.
She will. You know what she says about books.
What?
That they're sacred, that you're supposed to treat them with respect and stuff, because they're the keys that unlock doors.
Arthur couldn't remember Miss Karpinski saying those things, but it sounded like her all right. He must have been not concentrating at the time. A failure to concentrate was apparently one of his problems. He was 14 now and still in grade 8. He should have gone up to the high school on the other side of Struan with Carl and the rest of his class a year ago, but he'd failed the exams. Jake, on the other hand, had skipped a year, so now he and Arthur were separated by only 2 rows of desks. Arthur found this state of affairs almost unendurable, and the worst of it was that it looked set to go on forever. His father would have been happy for him to leave school as soon as the law allowed, which was the day he turned 16, but his mother had been so upset by his last report card that she'd said he was going to get his grade 12 if it took him the rest of his life. The fact was, it was going to take him the rest of his life. To start with, to pass grade 8, he would have to please Miss Karpinski, who was both judge and jury when it came to the exams. He couldn't imagine ever pleasing Miss Karpinski. Jake was still waving the book at him. "What am I going to say to Miss Karpinski?" he asked. His voice was shrill, with what appeared to be real anxiety, though with Jake you could never be sure. "Just tell her it was an accident."
"But Charlie Taggart says he's going to do it again. He says he's going to do it to every single one of my books unless I give him my milk money."
Arthur looked at him uneasily. Jake was a liar. You couldn't believe a word he said. But if by some unlikely chance he was telling the truth this time, and if he did get into trouble, and if Arthur were discovered to have known about it but not helped, his mother would never forgive him. "What do you want me to do about it?" he said reluctantly.
"Beat him up," Jake said promptly. "He's a bully."
Arthur's brow furrowed. Charlie Taggart was smart and had glasses, and Arthur didn't like him, but he didn't look like a bully. On the other hand, Jake didn't look like a bully either, but he was. Jake was a subtle bully, a devious bully. He specialized in getting people into trouble. Maybe he simply wanted to get Charlie into trouble. Or maybe Charlie wanted to get Jake into trouble. Or maybe Charlie did want Jake's milk money. Or maybe Jake had done something to Charlie, and Charlie threw the book into the mud to get even, and it had nothing to do with milk money. Where Jake was concerned, Arthur always felt he was in over his head, floundering in a sea of unknown possibilities.
"I can't just go beat him up," Arthur said.
Charlie was a little kid, and in any case, Arthur wasn't the beating-up sort. He was peaceable, given the choice. Even among his own friends, he didn't go in for the rough and tumble most of them engaged in.
"You have to," Jake said. "It's the only thing that will stop him."
"You can beat him up yourself," Arthur said. Jake gave him an exasperated look.
"He's bigger than I am."
The truth was, they were about the same size, but Jake never fought physically. Not that he was peaceable, but fighting was the one thing he wasn't good at, not with his bare hands, anyway. This was the year of Jake's obsession with knives, but Miss Karpinski didn't allow knives at school, which was a good thing in Arthur's view. His foot still hurt him sometimes where Jake had thrown the hunting knife into it, and the incident had involved him in all kinds of trouble because he'd had to make out that he'd done it himself. They'd both have been skinned alive if their father had discovered the truth. Arthur had had to pretend that he'd accidentally put the prong of a pitchfork through his foot while he was mucking out the barn, a lie that required him to ruin a perfectly good boot because no one would be fool enough to use a pitchfork with bare feet. "Why don't you just tell Miss Karpinski?" he asked. Jake looked shocked.
"You mean tell on him? You want me to tell on him?"
It was impossible, of course. Jake was right about that. To tell on someone was the one unforgivable sin. Arthur thought about it.
"I'll warn him," he said.
"You can't just warn him. He won't pay any attention to a stupid warning."
"I'll warn him that if he doesn't pay attention to the warning, I'll beat him up."
Jake kept at him the rest of the way home, but Arthur didn't budge. He had to keep out of trouble this year, or Miss Karpinski would keep him in grade 8 until he had a long gray beard. He approached Charlie Taggart in the schoolyard the next day, went up to the group of boys he was with, and stood right in front of him so he had to stop talking to the others and pay attention. Charlie looked up at him, his eyes large, spooky ovals behind his thick glasses.
"What?" he said.
"Leave my brother alone," Arthur said.
"What?"
Charlie said again, looking puzzled.
"You heard me,"
Arthur said. The words sounded pretty good. For a minute, he considered a new image of himself, a champion of rights.
"I'm warning you," he said ominously.
"I haven't done anything," Charlie said. He looked apprehensive but stubborn.
"You threw my brother's book in the mud," Arthur said. "If you do it again, I'll beat you up."
"I never touched your brother's book."
"You did so," Arthur said.
"I never touched anybody's stupid book." Arthur felt a shadow of doubt pass over him like a crow flying in front of the sun. He looked around for Jake, but Jake had vanished. He looked back at Charlie.
"You did so," he said again, louder, trying to keep the doubt out of his voice. Other kids were standing around, watching. "You said if he didn't give you his milk money, you'd do it to all his books."
Charlie said, "I didn't. I don't want your brother's stupid milk money. My dad runs the bank. I don't need your brother's stupid money. Your brother bet me his stupid money. I couldn't tell how he did that stupid trick with those two cards, and I did. And I didn't even take his money, because I don't need it. And my mom says, you farm kids are poor. I'm going to tell my dad you threatened me."
"I didn't threaten you," Arthur said. "I only said if you did it again, I'd threaten you."
"I'm going to tell my dad," Charlie said. And he did. And Mr. Taggart, who happened to be chairman of the school board that year, phoned Miss Karpinski, who sent a letter to Arthur's mother requesting that she come and see her, and Arthur's mother had to go and apologize for Arthur and was ashamed and humiliated to the soles of her shoes. There had been many times in the past when Arthur had wanted to give Jake a bloody nose, but never more than this time. He fantasized about it for days, saw his fist make contact, the lovely rich blood running down. But whenever and however he pictured it, his mother's face slid into the frame as well. The horror in her eyes, her bitter disappointment in him. So he didn't do it. The fact was, giving Jake a bloody nose wouldn't have answered the question that Arthur wanted answered. What had Jake been trying to achieve? A suspicion came to him after the event, a possibility that he hadn't considered at the time, and it bothered him, and he would have liked to be able to dismiss it. The suspicion was this: that Jake had no real quarrel with Charlie Taggart beyond a casual dislike and a resentment at having his card trick undermined, and that he'd never intended Arthur to beat Charlie up, and knowing Arthur so well, had never really thought he would. Because Charlie had never been Jake's target. It was Arthur he'd wanted to get into trouble all along. Was that possible? Could he have made up the whole business with a history book, muddied it himself, maybe, or dropped it accidentally and then decided to put the accident to use? Arthur worried at the idea, chewed at it. Finally, and with relief, rejected it, because there was no sense in it. Jake had no reason to do such a thing. And even Jake wouldn't get his own brother into so much trouble for no reason at all. Chapter 3. Rains douse bushfires. Number 11 Highway washed out. Temiskaming Speaker, May 1957. If he had thought about it properly, Ian would have realized that working on the Dunn's farm was not going to bring him all that close to Laura Dunn. Close to Arthur, yes, but that wasn't what he'd had in mind. Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, as he leaned his bike against the side of the barn, Laura came out and said, "He's down at the 10-acre, Ian. He said to go straight down." She pointed at the hedge running alongside the track. "Third field, along on the left. It's down a bit of a hill. That's why you can't see him from here. I think he said you're doing the potatoes today." "Okay," Ian said. "We have dinner at noon. I'll see you then." "Okay." And that was that. She went back inside. Contact time just less than a minute. Still, it was a minute more than he would have had otherwise, and he would see her at noon. It was a great morning. A pale blue sky, feathers of cloud off in the distance, a light breeze, still cool. It was only May, after all, but bearing the smell of summer to mingle with the smell of fresh manure. Manure was a bit of a problem underfoot. It seemed both horses and cows used the track. He was wearing his oldest shoes, but boots would have been better. In between watching his step, he looked at the fields. First on the left, pigs rooting about under a clutch of very old apple trees. First on the right, ploughed the dark soil freshly turned. Second on the left, ploughed. Second on the right, pasture, and about 30 cows, heads down, munching. They were getting a mixture of young and old grass. You could make out small bright green shoots poking up through the dry yellow of last year. From what he could see, the more distant fields were either ploughed or turned over to grass. Some of them were fenced with old zigzagged railings, others were edged with rocks and tree stumps, some fairly new, some so old that they had all but rotted away. Beyond the fields, the trees stood dense and dark, their tops tinged with the pale, indistinct green of new growth. When he reached the boundary of the third field, Ian could see Arthur and the horses as Laura had said. The horses were standing idle at one side of the field, unhitched from their wagon, heads together, as if they were plotting something behind Arthur's back. Arthur himself was out in the middle of the field, walking backward down a furrow. He was holding a bucket and kept picking stones out of it and dropping them into the furrow. Ian slowed down, mystified, wondering if maybe Arthur was soft in the head and no one had thought to tell him. Then he got it. Not stones, potatoes, seed potatoes. Arthur abruptly left the furrow and trudged to the side of the field. There was a large sack standing there, and now that Ian looked, he could see that there were more sacks positioned around the field, and more still on the wagon. Arthur bent and began to fill his bucket from the sack. When he straightened up, he saw Ian and put the bucket down and made his way up the side of the field to greet him. "Morning," he said. Ian gave him what he hoped was an enthusiastic grin. "Morning." "Potatoes today," Arthur said. "Great." Arthur was wearing muddy overalls and heavy work boots, clogged with mud, and what with his solid shape and mud-colored hair, Ian thought he looked pretty much like a giant potato himself. He knew women were supposed to be attracted to powerful-looking men, and Arthur definitely filled the bill on that score, but still it was hard to imagine what Laura had ever seen in him.
"Got you a bucket,"
Arthur said, and plodded back to the sack of potatoes, behind which Ian saw there was a second bucket.
"Fill it up," Arthur said. "Drop 'em in. About a foot apart. Like this, see?"
He took a potato out of his bucket, dropped it into a furrow, took a step back, dropped another one, and looked hopefully at Ian. Ian nodded, glad that none of his friends could see him. He imagined Pete saying very, very slowly,
"You take the potato out of the bucket, man, and then you drop it into the furrow, then you take a step backward, then you take another potato out of the bucket."
"You finish this row," Arthur said. He took his own bucket and headed off to the start of the next row. They planted seed potatoes for 4 hours. There was more to it than Ian had expected, in particular more pain. Pain from the stress of walking backward without collapsing the furrows as he went. Pain from the weight of the bucket. Pain from the curious posture required, head down, shoulders hunched. Well before the first hour was up, his muscles, all of them in every part of his body, reminded him of the diagrams of human musculature in his father's textbooks. The muscles were drawn in red ink and looked raw and stretched to breaking point. He kept himself going with thoughts of Laura. He thought about dinner time. Arthur would be there, which was a pity, but maybe after dinner he would go off for a nap and the two of them would be left alone. He imagined them sitting in the shade of an old apple tree, one without pigs around it, talking about this and that, enjoying the peace and each other's company, while Arthur snored in a room upstairs. At 12 o'clock, Arthur finally set down his bucket and trudged across the furrows to announce that it was time to go in. Ian followed him, gratefully, back to the house. They washed at the pump, the icy water numbing their hands and arms, two rangy dogs sniffing around Ian's ankles, the chickens clacking and strutting about. There was a towel hanging outside the back door. Arthur dried his hands on it and passed it to Ian, smiling shyly, looking as if he wanted to say something but couldn't think quite what it might be. And while he was thinking about it, Laura went past the screen door carrying a stew pot. She saw them and paused. "Oh, good," she said. "You're here. Come in and sit down. Ian, I've set a place for you beside Arthur." She gave them a rather harried smile and disappeared. Ian followed Arthur inside. The kitchen was like the kitchens of other farmhouses he'd been in, large and square, serving the function of living room as well. The cooking area was at one end of the room, and at the other was a wood-burning stove with a couple of armchairs crouched around it. The center of the room was taken up with a long wooden table. It was set for 7, and 4 of the places were already occupied. All morning he had been imagining that dinner would be a quiet, intimate affair, just Laura, Arthur, and himself, with Arthur not really counting. He'd entirely forgotten about the kids. There they were, all three of them, the boy who'd nearly knocked him off the steps, the small girl, and the baby in its high chair. There was also a very old man, propped up on cushions, and so bent over that his chin nearly rested on the table. Laura was ladling stew into the girl's bowl, and the girl was complaining about it. "We'll just leave them," Laura was saying. "Just pick them out and put them on one side." She smiled at Ian. "You're there, Ian." She pointed with her elbow, both hands being occupied with a stew pot. "Arthur's at the head of the table, and you're between him and Carter. Oh, I haven't introduced you. Carter, Julie, March." She indicated the children in descending order of age. "And this is my father. You may remember him. He was minister at the church for years. No, maybe you're too young." "Grandpa!" She leaned toward the old man and spoke loudly. "This is Dr. Christofferson's son, Ian. He's come to help Arthur." "Hello," Ian said uncertainly. Laura hadn't told him her father's name, but maybe it didn't matter because the old man gave no sign that he'd heard a word she'd said.
"But, Mummy,"
the little girl said, her voice reduced to a whisper by Ian's presence,
"they're all mixed up."
"You can pick them out," Laura said. "Look, like this." Ian followed Arthur down to the end of the table, trying to quell his disappointment. He sat down beside the boy, Carter, who was tapping the table with his knife, a complex rhythm of dots and dashes like Morse code, and didn't acknowledge Ian's presence by so much as a glance. He looked like Arthur, Ian thought, but not as nice.
"Ian?"
Laura said. Suddenly, she was standing so close to him that the sleeve of her dress nearly touched his arm.
"You'll be hungry, would be my guess. How did it go this morning?"
She began ladling stew onto his plate, not waiting for an answer.
"Say when?"
"When?" Ian said politely.
"Thanks, Mrs. Dunn. It looks wonderful."
It was worth all the agony of the morning to be this close to her. She gave him her lovely smile.
"Laura, you don't need to call us Mr. and Mrs., does he, Arthur?"
She had an apron on over her dress, which was pale blue with tiny white flowers on it. It had a V-neck, which was always a good thing because of where the V led to, but he couldn't see how low it went because it disappeared under the apron. She moved on swiftly, doling out everybody's stew. Finally, she went to her own place at the other end of the table, miles away from Ian. The baby was waving its arms about and making threatening noises.
"Shush," she said to it. "Are you going to eat nicely with us? Wouldn't you like a piece of carrot?"
She fished a bit of carrot out of the stew pot with her fingers and put it on the baby's tray. The baby threw it on the floor.
"I still haven't heard how it went this morning, Ian," Laura said, retrieving the carrot and putting it back on the baby's tray.
The baby picked it up and threw it on the floor again, and Laura sighed and left it there. She smoothed down the skirt of her dress as if in preparation for sitting down. Ian saw the swell of her hips and looked away.
"How was it? Did you find the work terribly hard? It won't be the sort of thing you're used to."
"Oh, Grandpa, hang on. That's a big piece. I'll just cut that up for you." She was off again, moving quickly around to her father's place to cut up his food. The old man watched her hands, mumbling to himself.
Ian said. "No, it was fine. Very interesting."
"Oh, good."
She went back to her place and finally sat down. A strand of hair had escaped from the ribbon at the nape of her neck, and she pushed it off her face with the back of her hand.
If only she would stay seated now. He wanted to savor her presence, but it was difficult to savor something that was continually flying about.
"Will you get as far as ploughing them in this afternoon, Arthur?" she said. "Because what Ian's really interested in is the horses." Carter said, "Isn't there any milk?"
He was at least 11 years old. You'd have thought he could walk to the refrigerator and get himself some milk. But Laura said,
"Oh, dear, of course there is."
Up again, over to the refrigerator, back with the milk, moving around the table, pouring it for everyone instead of letting them do it themselves.
"Really, I'm interested in everything," Ian said. "Not just the horses. You know, whatever needs doing is fine by me."
"You forgot the bread, too," Carter said.
Ian was sitting beside him, quite close. Close enough that he could easily reach over and thump him without even fully extending his arm, or just slide a foot around the leg of the chair and flip it out from under him. But Arthur was the one who should be sorting him out. If Laura was too kind and too soft-hearted to discipline her kids, and in Ian's view that was the problem, it was up to their father. But Arthur was busy eating. He ate like he did everything else, slowly, methodically, head down. When he did look up, Ian noticed, it was his wife his eyes rested on, not his children. Laura said, "What's the matter with me today?" Up again, down again with the bread. The baby screwed up its face, waved its arms about, and yelled. The little girl said, "But, Mummy, I can still taste it." Carter belched and grinned sideways up at Ian. None of them deserved her. There was someone in with his father when he got home, and Becky Standish was in the waiting room. In theory, his father dealt only with emergencies on the weekends, but the people of Struan had never paid too much attention to that, and there were always a couple of them who took advantage, as his mother called it. "Hi," Ian said to Becky. They were in the same class at school, and she was nice enough, though a bit dim.
"Hi," she said,
but she blushed and looked away, which meant she had a gynecological problem and was afraid he might ask her what was wrong. So he said, "See you later," and went down the hall to the kitchen. He left his mud-caked shoes outside on the porch, but his socks were leaving impressive footprints on their own. His mother was going to have a fit when she saw them. He'd say, "Well, I've been working, Mum. Dirt goes with the job." She was peeling carrots when he came in. Mrs. Tuttle didn't come on the weekends.
"I'm back," Ian said cheerfully.
He hurt everywhere, and he hadn't had a single moment with Laura to himself, but he felt unaccountably good.
"Fine," his mother said. She didn't turn around. "We'll eat as soon as your father's finished. Is there anyone in the waiting room?"
"Just one."
He was trying to assess her mood from the sound of her voice. It sounded different somehow, neither angry nor absent, but something else he couldn't identify.
"Fine," she said again.
"Do I have time for a bath?"
"If you're quick."
He waited for her to ask him how his first day at work had gone, but she just kept scraping carrots. After a minute, he said pointedly, "How was your day?"
"Fine."
For a moment she paused, her hands in the sink, and he thought she was going to turn around. But she didn't, so he left and went upstairs. He had a bath, let all the water run out, and had another one, which dealt with the worst of the grime. Given all the aches and pains, it was hard to say quite why he felt so elated. It wasn't as if he had found his true calling as a farmhand. In fact, he'd been embarrassed when, as he was leaving, Arthur had said, "Just a minute," then dug around in the pockets of his overalls and pulled out a handful of coins. Ian didn't think he'd earned them, and had wondered if he should say so, but then Arthur said, "See you next Saturday," with his vague, uncertain smile, and Ian had felt a rush of pride and gratitude. Arthur couldn't consider him too useless, or he wouldn't have asked him to come back. He'd done his first day's work, his first real work ever, and the quarters lying in the pocket of his mud-encrusted jeans were the proof of it. And he would do better next Saturday. He'd be a good worker. He imagined Laura saying to Arthur, "How did he do, Arthur?" And Arthur would think about it and then say, "All right, he's a good worker." You could take pride in that, no matter what the job. He wrapped a towel around his waist and went back to his room. It was tidy, everything in its place, the bed neatly made. His mother had always insisted on order. He'd tried rebelling once or twice, but it wasn't worth it. He wondered what Laura's kids would have been like if his mother had been their mother. Well, not their mother, because then they wouldn't be the same kids, but if by some fluke she'd been responsible for their upbringing, they'd be unrecognizable. Even the baby would be sitting up straight and eating with a knife and fork, a crisp, clean napkin tucked under its chins. He heard the clack of his mother's shoes as she walked down the hall to the waiting room. The sound disappeared for a moment, and then she came back and called him from the foot of the stairs.
"Supper, Ian."
"Okay." He went downstairs stiffly, his muscles protesting. His father was in the dining room, already standing by his chair.
"Hi,"
Ian said. He put the quarters Arthur had given him on the table beside his father's place.
"My first wages," he said proudly.
His father looked at him. It seemed for a moment as if he didn't recognize him. Then he smiled faintly and said, "Very good." Ian was disconcerted. He studied his father more closely. He looked strange.
"Are you okay?" Ian said.
"Yes," his father said. "Of course." His mother came in and set a covered serving dish on the table. The vegetable dishes were already there.
"We should sit down," she said.
She seemed strange as well. Her eyes were red, and he noticed that her hands were trembling. They sat down. Ian looked from one to the other. His mother began serving the meal. The scrape of the spoon on the side of the dish seemed to echo back from the walls.
"Is something wrong?" Ian said.
"Is this enough meat?" his mother said.
"Mom, is something wrong?"
She put down his plate. She studied it for a moment, and then looked down the table at his father.
"I have something to tell you," she said finally. "Your father and I have something to tell you."
Afterward, Ian excused himself from the table,
leaving his meal untouched. None of them had eaten anything, and went outside. At first he just stood on the porch, not knowing what to do or where to go. It was getting dark. Bats were flicking back and forth above the houses across the street. One of the Beckett kids from next door raced past on his bike, his crouched-over body a gray blur in the dusk. Ian stepped off the porch and started walking. He gave no thought to the direction. He wanted to walk and not to think. He walked fast, head down. His mother had done most of the talking. She'd started off by saying that she was leaving. He hadn't understood at first. Leaving what? And when he'd finally understood, he hadn't believed her. He'd thought she must be upset about something he or his father had done, and was saying it to punish them. He looked to his father for help, and it was his father's face that told him she was serious. She said that she and his father no longer loved each other, hadn't loved each other for years. His father tried to protest at this, but she stopped him. "Actions speak louder than words," she said. She had loved him once, and the proof of it was that she had given up 18 years of her life for him. She'd given up everything to come with him to this, she searched for the right words, this God-forsaken place, this wasteland. She had done all the giving. After the first couple of sentences, Ian had gone temporarily deaf. His mother carried on speaking, and he'd been able to hear the sound of her voice, but the words meant nothing. Then his father broke in. It seemed to Ian that his father had aged 20 years since they'd sat down. His face seemed to have caved in. He said, "Beth, for the love of God." To Ian, he said, "I'm sorry. We're both very sorry. Your mother is upset. She needs a little time away, that's all." His mother said, now he could hear her again, "Your father is still trying to pretend." By now, two clear lines of tears were running down her cheeks. Ian was so stiff with shock he could scarcely draw a breath. His father said, "Beth, please, please." He looked at Ian and said, "Don't be too upset. We hope very much that this will sort itself out." "It has sorted itself out," Ian's mother said, the shaking of her voice breaking the words into ragged syllables. "This is how it has sorted itself out." Ian couldn't look at either of them. His eyes were focused on the fine weave of the tablecloth in front of him. He hadn't even known they were unhappy, or at least with hindsight, he could see that his mother was unhappy, but he'd thought that was just how she was, her natural state. He'd taken it for granted that they loved each other. He'd assumed it the same way that he'd assumed they loved him. Now, suddenly, it came to him that that must be in doubt as well. Surely his mother wouldn't do this if she loved him. They'd been saying something, and again he hadn't heard it. His mother's voice had risen almost to a shout. There was a short silence, and then his father said, "Excuse me," and got up and left the room. Ian's mother stayed where she was, the tears shining on her cheeks. She was staring at the serving dish. After a minute, she took a deep breath and said, "That is typical. His leaving the room at a time like this is typical. But I am glad, because I have other things to say to you. He knows about them, your father knows about them, but I wanted to tell you privately, by ourselves." She went on to say them, these other things. She said she hadn't fully realized how little she'd had in life until she fell in love with a man who was in love with her. Genuinely in love. A man who was prepared to give things up for her. She said she and Robert Patterson were in love and were going to get married as soon as their respective divorces came through. In the meantime, they were leaving Struan as soon as possible. Robert had already identified a teaching job in Toronto. Here she looked up. Ian didn't look at her, but he could feel her gaze. She said, "I want you to come with us, of course. Robert will be happy to have you. He thinks you're a very fine boy. His children will stay with their mother, but we hope you will come with us. Will you? Will you come with us to Toronto?" Robert Patterson taught geography at the high school. Ian was in his class. He was a newcomer to Struan, having come from somewhere down south 3 or 4 years ago. He had a wife and 2 young children. He was tall and thin and had wire-rimmed glasses and a sarcastic manner. There was no way anyone could love him. Ian's mother said, "I am sorry to give you so little time, but we wanted to have everything settled, Robert and I, before telling you. I know it will be hard for you at first, leaving your friends and so on, but we'll be able to give you so much more. You know what Toronto is like." His incredulity and confusion were so great, he was unable to think. He struggled to find some order within himself, some coherent thought. After a few minutes, during which his mother waited silently, it came to him that there was one question he needed the answer to straight away. Maybe there were other questions, but they were unimportant compared to this one. He tried to assemble it in his mind to think how to phrase it, but when at last he managed to gather together the words and tried to voice them, he found he couldn't speak. His jaws felt wired together with tension. Finally, he managed. He said, aiming the words at the tablecloth because he could not look at her, "If I won't go, will you go anyway?" There was more silence, during which he tried to breathe normally. When she finally spoke, what she said was, "Ian, I want you to come with me. With us." Which was not the answer to his question, so he asked it again. He weighed out the words to make sure that she would understand and that he himself would understand their full meaning now and forever. "If I won't go with you, will you go anyway? Will you go without me?" This time, struggling with the shaking of her voice, she said, "Darling, you do not know what it has been like all these years." By which he understood, finally, that he was not important to her. Not that important. Afterward, he was impressed by his response, how calm it sounded, how polite. He said, "I'll stay here with Dad, if that's all right. But thank you for asking me." And then he excused himself and left the room. The dogs barked when they first got his scent, but then they remembered him from earlier in the day and came to greet him, wagging their tails. He stepped off the driveway when the dogs came up into the shadows of the trees. He didn't know why he was here. The last thing he wanted was for Laura to see him and come out and start talking to him. The thought of her knowing what had happened filled him with shame almost beyond endurance. What would she think? What would anyone think of a boy who meant so little to his own mother that she would walk off and leave him? In all his life he had never heard of such a thing. He'd heard of men abandoning their families, but never a woman, never a mother. He stood, uncertain, in the shadows for a few moments, and then cautiously moved toward the house. He went around to the back, where the kitchen was. He wanted to see her, that was all. He just needed to know she was still there. The farmhouse seemed bigger in the darkness than it had during the day. The house and the barn and sheds were solid blocks of night against the blue-black of the sky. The kitchen light was on, and there were lights in 2 of the bedrooms upstairs. Laura was in 1 of the bedrooms. He saw her moving back and forth, folding things, hanging things in the cupboard in the corner of the room. He could tell she was talking to someone, though he couldn't hear her voice or see anyone else. Probably the little girl, Julie. She must be putting Julie to bed. The boy, Carter, was in the other lighted bedroom. Ian had seen him cross the room. The baby must be asleep somewhere else. Arthur and the old man were downstairs in the kitchen. Arthur at the table, the old man huddled in a chair by the stove. Arthur was working on something, but Ian wasn't close enough to see what it was. He could have moved closer, but then he wouldn't have been able to see into the upstairs rooms. Anyway, he didn't care what Arthur was doing. It was only Laura he wanted to see. The dogs, who had followed him around to the back of the house, waited curiously beside him for a while, and then wandered off. From within the barn, he could hear the heavy, quiet movements of the horses. After some time, he didn't know whether long or short, the light in Julie's bedroom went off. He felt a sudden clench of anxiety, as if a life raft had slipped out from under him, but a minute later Laura appeared in the kitchen carrying the baby. He could see her better than when she was upstairs. The line of sight was more direct. She was still wearing the pale blue dress she had worn earlier, and her hair was still tied back, but it was looser, as if she allowed it its own way at the end of the day. She said something to Arthur, and he looked up at her and nodded, and then returned to his work. Laura went over to one of the big armchairs by the fire, lowered herself and the baby into it, and then quietly, discreetly, undid her dress and put the baby to her breast. Ian watched. It was more erotic, and at the same time more painful, than anything he had ever known. The day his mother left, he would not look at her. She left after breakfast, but he skipped breakfast. He stayed in his room. It was Sunday, but no one had suggested church. She came up to his room. He heard her footsteps, heard her stop at the closed door. He imagined her facing the door. After a minute, she knocked. He waited a bit, and then said, "Yes," in a tone completely devoid of interest. "May I come in?" "If you want." He heard the door open, heard her cross the room. He was at his desk, with his books spread out as if he were studying. He didn't turn around. She came to a stop behind him. He began to copy a section out of a book. She said, "Ian?" He waited a minute as if he'd been concentrating, and it had taken time for her interruption to filter through to him. "Yes." "Aren't you going to come down and say goodbye?" Her voice was shaking. "I have work to do." She was crying. He couldn't see her, and she made no sound, but he knew. He didn't care. He imagined what tomorrow was going to bring, and the next day, and the next, as the people of Struan heard the news. She said, struggling to control her voice, "Darling, how can I go if you won't say goodbye?" "Goodbye," he said. Chapter 4. Wheat crop is biggest since 1932. The average production of a cow. Temiskaming Speaker, September 1938. All the way through high school, Arthur didn't have a girlfriend. There were plenty of girls in his class at school, and he liked the look of many of them, but he didn't know how to approach them. What were you supposed to say? "Hello, my name's Arthur." They already knew his name. He should have approached them back in grade 9, when some of them, the ones from the small communities out in the sticks, were still strangers. But back in grade 9, he hadn't been interested. Sometime during his first year in grade 10, that had changed almost overnight. One minute, girls were irrelevant, and the next, he couldn't stop looking at them. He and his friends would hang about during recess and lunch hour, watching the girls walk by in little gabbling groups. That was one of the problems. Females didn't come individually, they came in packs. You'd have to walk up to a whole pack, which was out of the question. By the time he was 16, legally old enough to leave school, but of course his mother wouldn't let him, most of the boys he knew had worked it out and were at least able to talk to girls, if nothing more. Some of the more advanced, more confident ones even professed to be fed up with women already. "They ain't worth the trouble, Art. Take it from me, they just ain't worth the trouble." Arthur would have liked the chance to find that out for himself, but there was no way. His friend Carl urged him on. "Go on, Art. What you waiting for? Just go up and ask her." But it was no use. He didn't know how. Jake, on the other hand, was born knowing. As with schoolwork, Jake had no trouble with girls at all. When Arthur was 17 and just entering grade 11, having taken 2 years over grade 10, Jake started high school. He was 12. 5 years behind Arthur in age, 2 years behind him in school, ahead of him already in the matter of girls. Arthur would see him chatting to them in the schoolyard, easily, casually, as if they were friends instead of a different species. In fact, Jake had more friends who were female than male. Other boys were a bit suspicious, maybe even a little afraid of him. He had the ability to get people into trouble. Anyone who had been through primary school with him knew that. Arthur had forgotten how bad it was having Jake in the same school. When he started high school, he'd had 2 glorious years without him, and now, looking back, he saw that he hadn't appreciated those years enough. Jake took to high school as if it had been invented just for him, all those new subjects to excel in, all those new teachers to impress. He talked about the things he was learning at the supper table every night. "They don't teach you arithmetic anymore, they teach you mathematics. And there are 3 different mathematics. There's algebra and geometry and trigonometry. Geometry's all about lines and stuff, and trigonometry's about triangles and how to work out angles and stuff, and algebra's where you use letters instead of numbers." Arthur was sure Jake's enthusiasm was fake, put on to impress their parents, but still it stuck in his throat and made it difficult for him to swallow his supper. "See, in Latin, nouns have different forms, and they have different endings, loads of different endings, and we have to learn them all. So I wondered if someone could test me after supper." Jake kept slipping sideways looks at their father as he said all this. Their mother would be hanging on every word, her face pink with pleasure, but it was their father's reaction he seemed interested in. But his father just chewed silently, pushing down the food.